of my main focus for most of my life as a physicist. And one might ask, why is it that in quantum gravity progress is so slow? One reason, of course, is just that it's a hard problem. Another reason that's obvious is that we don't have much direct experimental guidance in the matter. But I think a third reason is what I've written here, is that we still haven't learned how to think clearly about the quantum world in itself without reference to observers and other external agents. Because of that, we don't really know how to think about the Planckian regime where there are no observers and where quantum gravity is expected to be most relevant. So we don't know how to think about what happens in the early universe. We don't know how to think about what happens deep inside a black hole. We don't know how to think about what happens even in the vacuum on very small scales. And these, of course, are the places where quantum gravity is supposed to be most relevant. In particular, there's a problem that's come up in connection with causal set theory, which I won't go into, either causal set theory or the problem, but it has to do with the meaning of relativistic causality, the same kind of causality that in its classical incarnation goes into the proof of Bell's theorem. So in causal set theory, we made heavy use, in fact, David and I made heavy use of a notion called Bell causality in designing a classical dynamics for causal sets. We've blocked in extending that to the quantum case because we don't know how to think about causality. And the specific question is how, without an observer-free notion of reality, how does one give meaning to superluminal causation or its absence in a causal set? If we could answer that, hopefully we would be able to proceed to mimic what we did in the classical case. So for me, that's the specific background, and the specific thing that I would hope from a better understanding of quantum mechanics is to be able to pose these questions and to answer them in a fruitful way for quantum gravity. So it's not that we have no intuitive idea of what the quantum world is like. I think everyone who works in quantum mechanics has such an idea. For example, I think people who are thinking about, say, condensed matter, say, superfluidity, probably don't, when they're thinking about a roton, for example, they're not probably thinking of a self-adjoint operator. They're thinking something else, but that something is peculiar to them, and it's not part of a coherent descriptive framework. So what we lack is this coherent descriptive framework for the microscopic quantum world. In other words, we lack a answer to the question, what is a quantum reality, a quantum reality? So what I want to do in this talk is propose an answer to that question. More precisely, it's a family of possible answers, all related by some technical differences. And then I want to explain in particular how the measurement problem, as it's called, can be posed in this framework and plausibly solved. But what I'll actually claim is that the measurement problem is, quote unquote, reduced to a calculation. If the calculation comes out the right way, then the problem is solved. Needless to say, it's not a very easy calculation. So here's an outline of what I will be saying. At the top are some of the people who have been involved in this work. See, the colors don't come out too well. This is supposed to be green, but does it look too green, like green to people? Does it look red? This is green. This is red. This is blue. This is orange. Okay. Well, next time. I don't know if there's, maybe the light is too bright. Anyway, but you can meet it anyway, right? Okay. So the introduction I've told you already, and then the main inputs to the interpretation that I'm going to be proposing are threefold. First of all, the idea of histories, which comes very much out of quantum gravity. I believe that there's that really any successful formulation of a quantum gravity theory will be based on a histories approach or a space-time approach as opposed to a canonical approach. So that's one reason. But it turns out, I think, as many other people, but not maybe the majority of people, have also been led to believe that a histories approach is much better, just even for the interpretational issues themselves. So the first input is the idea of history. I'll say something about what I mean by that. The second is less familiar, at least in its terminology, and that's preclusion, which will be the statement that certain kinds of events don't happen, and I'll define exactly what I mean by an event. And the third one is the particular description, the anhomomorphic co-event, that will be the description of a quantum reality. So it'll be the answer to the question, what is a quantum reality? The thing leading to that will be a certain conflict between the idea of preclusion and the reasoning of classical logic. And so that's where this word anhomomorphic co-event I'll define. It's like a description of all possible events. And anhomomorphic is the non-classical, as you'll see, not homomorphic. Hopefully you'll see why that's an appropriate name for non-classical. Then I'll describe the particular scheme. I said that there were many schemes all in the same general family. I'll describe this multiplicative scheme, which looks like the most promising at the moment. At least it's the simplest one to work with. And how the measurement problem looks with respect to that scheme, and a theorem that if the hypotheses of the theorem can be verified, will, I claim, solve the measurement problem. I was going to illustrate it with a particular, I'll illustrate it with a three-slit, but that's a very rudimentary example. There's some more interesting examples, but I saw that there wouldn't be time for this, so I didn't even really prepare a transparency for it, although I have notes. And then I'll finish with the open questions, of which there are, needless to say, many questions. Yes. Well, probably it wouldn't be good to get into a long discussion of quantum gravity here, but I wouldn't say I dismiss any approach out of hand, but I do dismiss canonical approaches. So if by that you mean the canonical version of loop quantum gravity, then I ultimately think it'll fail. Yes, I mean, I think, I don't want to go here into the reasons, but I'd be glad to explain them. It's just because it's a canonical approach, which doesn't mean that things can't be learned from some of these approaches. But I think I've thought for many years that canonical is ultimately a dead end. However, you might include within that, you might include spin poems, and they are of history's nature. So it depends where you want to draw the line about which poem he has to kind of approach. So as I said, there were three basic conceptual inputs into this interpretation: histories, preclusion, and anhomomorphic, or the idea of co-event, let's say. Let me talk first about histories. In the time of classical physics, it was easy to say what reality was, not in detail what, you know. It wasn't easy to give a full count of all of reality, obviously, but it was easy to say what kind of thing reality was, what would count as a possible reality. For example, in general relativity, which is a classical theory, the answer would have been a four geometry. In other words, a diffeomorphism equivalence class of Lorentzian metrics. This is pure gravity. If there was more matter, you'd add more fields, you'd have diffeomorphism equivalence. To take a very different example, which I think in many ways is closer to quantum mechanics than classical deterministic mechanics was, is Brownian motion, which is a stochastic theory. In that case, we're dealing with the motion of a single particle, and we're ignoring whatever other particles are knocking into it and knocking it around. So in that case, reality is just a single world line, a continuous world line, actually not a differentiable world line, but it's a single world line. And the dynamics is given, unlike by, like in general relativity, where it's given by a deterministic differential equation, the dynamics is given in that case by a set of transition probabilities. Or more technically, more mathematically correct, it's given by a measure, a probability measure on the space of all world lines, which I'll call the history space. And we'll see that quantum mechanics is very much like that when thought of in the history's framework. So in this classical world, we could survey, in principle, all the possible realities, all the four geometries, all the world lines of the grounding particle, or whatever. And we could also state the dynamical laws that further circumscribe them. In other words, you could imagine all the possible motions, say all the possible four geometries, and then you have the Einstein equations, which cuts that space of possibilities down to a relatively small subset, which are the ones that are dynamically allowed. So this notion of a possible reality, classical possible reality, which is a four geometry or a world line or some other field configuration or whatever, depending on the theory, that's what I mean by history. That, when I say history, that's what I mean. Some people call this a fine-grained history. But in any case, the word history is being used in the same sense as when people speak of the sum over histories, when people describe the path integral as a sum over histories. What I mean by history is the thing that's being summed in the sum over histories. Let me just ask if there's any question on that, since sometimes people are used to another language. Okay. So let me introduce a little bit of notation now. First of all, I'll call the space of all histories omega. I'll call the, then a crucial notion is the notion of event. Event is just, leaving aside technicalities like whether it's measurable or not, an event is just a subset of omega. In fact, for the rest of this talk, I'll just assume that omega is finite to avoid all these technical issues like measurability. So an event is just a subset of omega. Now why, this is the standard word that's used in probability theory and theory of stochastic processes. But in fact, it's just a very good word for a physicist, and it's a very good word for an everyday use as well. So when we speak in an event, here's an example. An event is it rained all day yesterday. Now, it might be that that event really did happen, or that event really did not happen. But in any case, it represents a set of histories. If our physical theory, so to speak, was the weather, say that's some sort of, ultimately, if we wanted to break it down to that, it's some set of world lines for all the molecules in the atmosphere and so on. Some of those configurations have raindrops moving down, and some of them don't. Those which do belong to the event that it rained, and those which do not belong to the event that it didn't rain. So, so event then will be a subset of the history space. It's the histories in which you would have said that that event happened. The notion of co-event will come up later, but I'll just mention it here for future reference. Which I'll be always representing it by the letter phi. A co-event will be an answer to every question that you could have asked about, did this event happen? Will that event happen? So if I knew the full co-event, then I would know the answer to whether it rained yesterday, and I'll know the answer to every other question that you might ask. So the idea is that this co-event will be the complete description of quantum reality. And of course, the purpose of the dynamical laws is to make restrictions on this co-event. So the co-event phi answers every possible, well, I've just said that. Just remark that it's somehow, logically speaking, this is a higher order object. since an event can also be called in another language a predicate, it picks out those histories for which the answer is yes, or those propositions which are true, depending on which language. This assigns to every such predicate true or false, or yes or no, so therefore it's sort of, if you like, a predicate of predicates. So that's the idea of co-events. Now, as I said, history classically corresponds to a single, reality, I should say, existence or reality or possible world or whatever language you like to use, corresponds to just a single history. Quantum mechanically, reality ought to, therefore, using some sort of linguistic argument, correspond to a quantum history. The question, however, is what exactly do we mean by a quantum history? That, again, is what I'm trying to answer. I won't give you the answer immediately, but I will tell you what the answer won't be. This is related also to the question on canonical gravity. Reality will not be a wave function. And in particular, the Schrödinger equation won't be entering the story at all. It's important to keep in mind, this is not, for example, a many worlds interpretation or even a Bohmian interpretation in which reality is partly the wave function. We won't be talking about wave functions. We'll be talking instead about histories and the path into them. So the second input is, as I said, the first input to this was the idea of history, the idea of event, the idea of co-event, and so on. The second input is the idea of preclusion. So I have to say what I mean by that. Preclusion comes out of what I'll call the quantum measure. And just as histories were, in some sense, the kinematical input to the theory, this idea of preclusion is the dynamical input. So one is the analog of, well, using the old-fashioned language, kinematics, description of all possible motions and dynamics, which motions actually occur. Here we want to know which co-events actually can occur. But that's getting a little bit ahead. So anhomomorphic logic, which we haven't got to yet, grows out of the path integral. But when we talk about the path integral, we have to think about it in a slightly different way, perhaps, than you're used to. You might be used to thinking of the path integral as some sort of propagator, something used to evolve a wave function. I've told you that the wave function won't be occurring, but the path integral will. So how is that possible? When we do a computation with a path integral, what are we actually computing? So one way of answering this is to imagine doing some sort of quantum mechanical experiment in which you include the apparatus in the physical system, all the apparatus and so on that is needed for this experiment, and imagine that you compute the probability of a particular outcome of the experiment according to the usual rules, which will only actually be approximate here, but imagine you compute them according to the usual rules. You can cast that computation in a path integral language, and what you end up doing is computing what I'll call a measure, a quantum measure. You compute a number for the set of histories in which the pointer points this way, and you compute another number for the set of histories in which the pointer points that way. And those things can be interpreted in that situation as a probability, according to the usual rules of Born rule and reduction and so on. Specifically, it's a probability of a succession of position events, in this case, position events of the pointer. Now, the point is that this probability can be written purely in terms of the path integral. I won't show you how to do it. If the words Schwinger-Keldysh mean anything to you, that's coming very close to indicating what the answer is. But you can write it purely in terms of a path integral. And what you find that you've computed in the end is a number associated to a particular event, in this case, the event of the pointer going one way or the other. In fact, that expression that you get can be applied for any event. That is, you can take any set of histories and it'll give you a number, a non-negative real number. It's really related a little to what we heard before about the two, the doubling of the line. That's the Swinger-Felder's formalism. So in any case, what it does is it produces for each set of events, each set of histories, it produces a non-negative real number, which I'll call the measure mu, or the quantum measure of that set. It's some sort of generalization of the idea of probability measure, like the probability of all paths of the Brownian particle in which it goes outside the room in that direction, for example. Another name that's used for it is decoherence functional, especially by people who work in consistent history. Now, let me just make a little aside about this quantum measure. Mathematically, it's a very interesting object. You can use it, you can view it as a kind of generalization, as I said, of a probability measure. And it's what, also as referred to Lucian's framework, this square, this two. In another way of looking at it, it obeys a certain sum rule, which is not the classical sum rule that probabilities of disjoint events add, but because there's interference. But what this sum rule tells you is that there can be interference between pairs of events, but there's no new sui generis interference among triples of events. And this sum rule is very interesting because it's completely general. Any quantum theory, no matter what it's of, as long as it's a quantum theory, satisfies this sum rule. And therefore, it's interesting to test it experimentally and see whether or not you can see any evidence of a violation of quantum mechanics. It can be tested in particular in a three-slit experiment, just as the two-slit experiment shows the presence of interference with this alternative and this alternative. The probabilities don't add up, or the measures don't add up. The three-slit experiment can show the presence of this sum rule, that the interference doesn't go farther than pairs. And this actually is being done now in IQ over at IQC. So I don't know, in a couple of months or so, maybe we'll have some bounds on the violation of this higher sum rule. But for us, the main point is that although there is this three-level sum rule, although it's a level, quantum mechanics is a level two measure theory and not a level three or level four or so on measure theory. The important thing is that it's not a level one measure theory. There is interference. So the probability of going, I mean, the measure of all the paths that go through this slit plus the measure of all the paths that go through this slit is not equal to the measure of all the paths taken as a whole because of interference. And because of interference, this measure mu cannot be interpreted in general as a probability. I told you that in certain special cases where you have to do with instrument events and so on, it can be approximately interpreted as a probability, but in general, it cannot. In general, in fact, we don't know really what it means. It's what the path integral gives us, but what does it mean physically? From a history's point of view, this is the problem of interpretation of quantum mechanics. So understand the meaning of this quantum measure, mu. I'm proposing to interpret mu now in terms of a preclusion postulate. In fact, if you go back to even a classical probability theory like Brownian motion, if you think hard enough about it, you can convince yourself that you don't know what classical probability means either. In other words, you don't know what the measure mu means in that case. It's very easy for me to convince myself of mu since then. I don't know about other people. But one thing that you can sort of hang on to, and it's been made the basis of a whole interpretation of probability theory called Cournot's principle, that was the, in particular, the view of Kolmogorov, who founded the modern mathematical version of probability theory. One way of interpreting what the classical probability means is that when it's zero, when the probability of an event is zero, that event does not happen. Remember, an event is a set of histories. Probability measure will give you the measure of that set. And when it's zero, we say that that just will not happen for all practical purposes or whatever words you want to use. So I've introduced a word borrowed from Bob Geroch, a preclusion. We will say that such an event is precluded, dynamically forbidden. the hope is to get all the meaning of probability out of that preclusion or approximate preclusion, maybe when it's very small, which is another can of worms. In quantum mechanics, however, it can actually be zero. And so let's, for starters, interpret mu in terms of this preclusion postulate. This does make sense also for the quantum measure. And what the postulate says is this: if E is an event, a subset of omega, and if E, so here was my sample space, and this is a particular event, I'll be usually calling them E or A. If the measure, this thing computed by the net amplitude, so to speak, computed by the path integral, if it vanishes, then E does not happen. And in the notation I've adopted, I'll write this in terms of the coevent phi by saying phi of E equals zero. If phi equals phi of E. If phi of E equals one, then that means that says E happens, or E is true, whatever language you like to use. And if it equals zero, then it doesn't happen. It's false, again, whatever language you like to use. So this is the preclusion postulate. And the idea here is that the whole dynamical content of quantum mechanics is reduced to this preclusion rule. So that's the second input. The third input, the anhomomorphic logic, we'll have to wait a second, because why do we need this? The reason we need it is that this preclusion rule, although it sounds very simple, already leads to a contradiction. It leads to a conflict. At least it's a contradiction with classical logic. So let me illustrate this in the case of what I'm calling the three-slit paradox or contradiction. So this is a three-slit experiment like I referred to before, but it's not the same. The purpose is not the same here. So imagine, we're not checking for this higher sum rule to be satisfied. We'll just do ordinary quantum mechanics where it's satisfied automatically. So this is a situation in which we have a source, three slits, and a particle, as usual, diffracting particle with many different possible trajectories. Here I've drawn the three of interest. So I'll identify three events, which I call little a, little b, and little c, which is that the A is that the particle goes through slit A, and so on. And then there's another event, which I call D, which is that the particle arrives at this place. And you might imagine putting the detector there, but I'm not doing it. So we're just talking about the particle world lines. If you wanted the detector, you'd have to include it in the system as well. Okay. So there's the event little d, there's the events A, B, and C. And we can choose things so that the amplitudes for these three trajectories, or sets of trajectories, are plus one for the left slit, plus one for the right slit, and minus one for the center slit. So some of the events here are, for example, d little dA, which means D and A. So it means it goes through this slit and it arrives at D, little dB, and so on. Then there's an event like dA plus dB. That means the union in this case. It's actually the XOR operation, what's called symmetric difference. But in this case, they're disjoint. So it's just the union, and so on. So that means it either goes through A or it goes through B and it arrives at D, and so on. And finally, there's the one of main interest, which is D itself. Does the particle arrive here? I'm going to limit myself just to these histories which do arrive at D, so to not to worry about the others and pretend that the whole sample space is just those. The whole sample space or history space is just those. In this case, little d, which is the whole history space that I'm looking at, is just A plus B plus C, arriving at D via the first slit, arriving at D via the second slit, are arriving at B, B as a third state. So what are the preclusions in this situation? Which events have measure zero? Well, it's easy to pick them out. If you forget about this and look only at the first two, then the amplitudes cancel. There's destructive interference. So the set A plus B is precluded. In the same way, the set B plus C, this is big B plus big C, is also precluded. On the other hand, if we take the whole set of trajectories, A plus B plus C, which is D, its measure is, of course, non-zero, because when you add up the amplitudes and square them, you just get 1 squared. So here we see the contradiction with classical logic. If we say that the event A plus B cannot happen, and the event B plus B, C can not happen, let's say it can't arrive at D through the first pair of slits, it can't arrive at D through the second pair of slits. In classical logic, that would just mean that it cannot arrive at D. But of course, quantum mechanically, it can arrive at D. So we shouldn't say, we shouldn't be able to conclude that that event D is precluded, because sometimes it actually can happen. This is the sort of simplest version I know of the paradox, the conflict between classical logic and quantum mechanics, viewed in this history's way. But it's also the prototype for all the other, what I would call, logical paradoxes. So the Cohen-Strecker paradox, viewed in a history's way, is the same thing. Alan Stair's version of it, which is the way anti-hidden variables that brings in locality, the sort of logical version of Bell's, and the other ones that are like that, the GHZ, Lucian's paradox, all of these have the same character, which is you have a history space, you have a set of a bunch of precluded events of measure zero, and those precluded events cover the history space. Nothing is left over. So since these involve only logic, we can hope to solve them by a logical modification to our logic. Whoops, I have to speed up a little bit. Okay, so and that modification is what I'm calling anhomomorphic coevents. So we have here a contradiction. I argued we had a contradiction between this preclusion principle on one hand and classical logic on the other hand. Now, one reaction to it might be, well, let's change the preclusion principle. You can try that, but what seems, and I did try that myself, but what seems to work better is to modify classical logic, or more precisely, modify the rules of logical inference in a way that in the end is not very much of a change, at least in this multiplicative scheme. So to make that sound less awful, let me say a couple of words about how you might view logical inference. It seems to me that for a physicist, it's natural to think that logical inference, or logical deduction, if you like, is a special case of dynamics. Why do I say that? Well, think of how you use dynamics. For example, using Kepler's laws to forecast an ellipse. What you're doing is you're saying, well, if the moon was here and the Earth was here on Sunday, and then the moon was here and the Earth was here on Monday, then on Wednesday the moon will be in the bottle and we'll have an eclipse, for example, or we won't have an eclipse. In other words, you're getting relationships among events. If this event happened and that event happened and this event didn't happen and so on, then this such and such an event won't happen. There won't be an eclipse. Well, what is deduction? What is logical deduction? It's the same thing, right? Except the events are more like event A happens, event B happens, therefore event A or B happens. It's a kind of relationship among events, but whether they're happening or not happening. But it's so universal that we sort of think of it as a priori. We've learned to think of it as a priori, just as we used to think of geometry as a priori before general relativity. What I'm saying is that we want to bring logic into physics in the same way that general relativity brought geometry into physics. And so it's not so impermissible to tamper with logical inference if the quantum experience tells us that we should. So to explain how I want to do that, let me introduce what I'll call the logical triad. I don't know why this German letter came out so huge, but maybe someone who understands LaTeX better than me could explain it, but fix it. But anyway, it did. So this A is the set of all events, this German A. So each E is an element of this. This is the algebra of events. It turns out it's a Boolean algebra. Just it's a bunch of sets. And the co-event maps it into Z2. In other words, for each event, it assigns true or false. It happens or it doesn't happen. One way to talk about A is in terms of questions. Each element of A is asking a question about the world, and phi is giving the answers to all the questions. Only certain patterns of answers are allowed because of our inference rules, our dynamical rules. And those which are allowed, each one of them describes a possible reality, or what you might call a quantum history. So what I'll call a quantum history is at least described by a set of consistent, according to the rules, answers, that is by an allowed co-event, phi. Rules of logical inference in general, now getting back to ordinary logic, rules of logical inference can be viewed as conditions on phi. I'm just proposing to unify them with the dynamical conditions on phi. However, we have to change the standard logical rules. In doing so, I will not change the event algebra. It'll still be the set of histories. I won't change the truth values. It'll still be yes or no. But we will modify the conditions that we impose on phi in order to come ultimately in order to accommodate interference. One other comment that I have to make in relation to the so-called multiplicative scheme is that both truth and falsehood make a difference. Sometimes logicians just think you should try and derive true statements from true statements. That's the whole purpose of inference. But here it's important to distinguish. It's important to think about what certain statements being false, others being true, and to derive truth or falsehood of some statement from truth or falsehood of other statements. So physically what I'm trying to say is that if we affirm, sometimes if phi of E equals one, I'll say that phi affirms E. It's very shorthand. It says that E happens. So to affirm that the particle is here is not really the same thing as denying that the particle is elsewhere. And this is not something that this is something that some people have recognized, I think, thousands of years ago. If you ask if there's time or later on, I can tell you what this tetralemma is. It's some famous thing in Buddhist logic that illustrates this point of view. So what are the classical rules of inference that we're going to modify? There are three ways of expressing them. I guess the colors didn't come out too well. The first one is supposed to be color-coded. So this is green. This is called modus ponens. It's the statement that if phi of A is 1 and A and phi of A implies B is 1, then phi of B is 1. Syllogism or something like that. Then there's this one, which is important because this one is going to change, is that if phi of A is 0, then phi of not A is 1. Now, if a certain statement is false, then its negation is true. That's a rule of ordinary logic. And then phi of 0, 0, the empty event, never happens. Another way of saying these rules that's entirely equivalent is that phi is a homomorphism of unital Boolean algebras. Okay. I won't. That's why the word anhomomorphic has come. But just since I'm running out of time, I'll just say not more about this. And then here's a third equivalent way. So it's a theorem that actually Faye Dauker proved that this first set implies the second or the third. And the third one is that this uses some jargon, which you might have heard before, that the phi inverse of one, which is the set of all true events, is a maximal preclusive filter in the history space. Now I won't define that. I won't have to actually define it for you, but I can if someone is interested. But let me tell you, the reason I said it like that is that it directly leads to the multiplicative scheme, this particular version of anhomomorphic logic. And what is that scheme? We retain all the rules that I showed you before of logical inference if we use the formulation of 3. We retain 3 word for word as the definition, which is that phi is a maximal filter, but it has to be a preclusive filter. By preclusive, I mean that phi obeys the preclusion principle. It never assigns 1 to a precluded event. If we take that over word for word, it produces what I call the multiplicative scheme. This one that I showed you before, that if something is false, its complement is necessarily true, that does not get satisfied. Both the statement and its negation can be false. So an event and its complement can both fail to happen. That's the one big change. It's the reason I haven't defined preclusion for, filter for you, if there's another formulation which is more direct, more easy to see, and easier, much easier to draw. And here's what it says. It says that any co-event, any phi which satisfies this condition that I wrote down, can be viewed in the following way. We have the whole history space. And here's a particular event A, a particular event B, and a particular event C. We want to know which of those events happen according to phi and which ones do not. Phi can be represented always itself by a subset, which I've called here F, of the history space, which I've written saying by phi is F star. And the rule is that an event happens if and only if it contains this F, this support of the co-event. So reality is represented in this scheme, not by a single history, but basically by a set of histories. So in this case, A happens because it contains F, C does not, and B, although it meets F, doesn't contain F, so it also doesn't happen. So notice that truth is somehow a collective property of histories here. It's easy to see that this reduces to classical logic when interference is absent, that is when we're dealing with classical probabilities. It also, in another case in which there aren't probabilities at all, which is classical mechanics, which is just deterministic theories, which just divide all possible histories into those which satisfy and don't satisfy the equations of motion. There's not even a probability measure. Nevertheless, this exact preclusion rule reproduces those. But it would have reproduced them if I had said a crucial thing, which I forgot to say, which I wrote here. Which is that this, how do we choose this F? Not any set is allowed. It has to be as small as it possibly can without coming into conflict with the preclusion rule. In other words, this F should not shrink so small that it gets inside any precluded event, otherwise it should be as small as possible. So in the case where there are no precluded events, then it just shrinks down to a point, a single history, and you recover classical logic. Let me illustrate this. I have about a minute or so. Let me briefly introduce, 5 minutes? Okay, I'm more. So let me introduce this slightly less briefly then, with the three-slit experiment. I mean, apply this to the three-slit experiment, which we saw before. Remember, there were 3 possible events, and and 2 preclusions. So the 3 events of interest were A, going through the left slit and arriving at D, and B and C. And remember, A or B, the event A or B, which is going through the first set of slits on the left, was precluded. So that this orange line is meant to show precluded. So the event A or B has to be 0. So in this case, phi of A plus B equals 0. And similarly, phi of B plus C equals 0, the symmetric situation. So what's the smallest set F that I can make of this subset of this 3-element space, which doesn't fall inside any precluded event? Well, it can't be contained within A or the union, you know, the set consisting of A and B, so it must contain C. and it can't be contained within B union C, so it must contain A. So that's the answer. It's just A plus C. The preclusive event is given by F star, where F, this thing here, F is A plus C. And that's illustrated here by this greenish line. In fact, there are two preclusive co-events, A plus C star and A plus B plus C star, meaning that they don't violate the preclusion rule, but one is smaller than the other. And so this smaller one is the only one that's allowed, the ones that we call primitive. So reality is to be identified with or described by a primitive preclusive co-event. We just don't know which one it is, of course. But the statement that it is one is already a strong restriction. In this case, the situation is so simple that there's only one such co-event. But in general, there'll be very many. So just to fill out the co-event, we could say in this case, two events happen, A plus C, A plus B plus C, and all the other events do not happen. So if you ask, does it go through the left slit, the answer would be no. Does it go through the left or middle slit, the answer is no. Well, that was precluded, and so on. But does it go through the left or right slit, the answer would be yes. And of course, does it go through any slit at all, the answer would be yes. So the important thing is that this thing that can happen experimentally can happen here as well. The co-event makes it happen, and so the paradox is removed. Okay, so that's a very brief indication of what the multiplicative scheme is. Now, how does it solve the measurement problem? Let's review where we are. We have the notion of co-event, which now give us a direct description of microscopic reality in the sense that we can answer any question, if we know the co-event, that you could ask about it. And we introduced this notion of logical deduction or inference, which resolves the logical paradoxes. But does it solve the measurement problem? Well, we have to ask, what is the measurement problem in this way of looking at things? As far as I can see, what the measurement problem is the statement, it's the Schrodinger cat and so on. It's the statement that if you think in a certain way using the wave function, then you can't say that one or the other outcome has actually happened. If we can show that given two alternative outcomes in the instrumental world, that for any one of these primitive co-events, it either assigns true to one and false to the other, or vice versa, that it makes one and only one happen, that will solve the measurement problem. So to say it more abstractly, the restriction of the co-event to the, not the full event algebra, but the algebra of instrument events must be classical. Because if classical, or at least that's a sufficient condition, if classical logic governs the macroscopic events, then in classical logic, one and only one history occurs. You can prove that, and it's very familiar anyway. So that would resolve the problem. Here's a theorem that shows how the problem could be resolved. So let phi be one of these primitive preclusive co-events, one of these descriptions of a possible reality. And now suppose we divide the suppose we divide our whole history space into two portions. So here's omega, and here's sort of omega prime and omega double prime. This one says that the pointer pointed this way, and this one says that the pointer pointed that way. So that covers the whole history space. So suppose that this is a partition of the history space. Let it have this property, that any event A is precluded if and only if its intersections with omega prime and omega double prime are separately precluded. Okay. Here's a precluded event. If both this and this are precluded, whenever the whole event A is precluded, then it has this preclusive separability. The partition has this preclusive separability condition. It's closely connected to, did I write this somewhere? Oh, no, sorry. Okay, if that's true, then you can prove that the support of phi, this F, lies wholly within omega prime or wholly within omega double prime. So classical logic applies to the cut down history space of two elements, and that resolves the measurement problem. The proof is actually not too long, but a little too long to give here. What it means is that either omega prime happens or omega double prime, but not both. The pointer points this way or this way, but not both. The question then is, however, is it reasonable that events, macroscopic events, really have this property? Since Harvey's standing up, I'll just skip this. But let me say, let me just say that this is closely related to the idea of a record. And I think it's a little stronger than what we can actually believe macroscopic events do have. I'll just finish by saying what I think we can believe that they have, and which by a slightly longer proof yields the same result. And that's this condition here. This deals just with one of these elements of partition, say omega prime. So if a sub-event of omega prime, that is an A within omega prime, but if it lies within some other precluded event, P, let's say, then it also lies within a precluded event confined to omega prime. I hope I said that right. Anyway, if it has this property, then you get the same conclusion. So in this sense, the measurement problem reduces to a calculation. We need to show that macroscopic, or at least instrument events, have this property that I just wrote them. I was going to put some open questions up. I'll put them up, but I won't talk on them. I'll just stop here.